Abandonment and Renewal. Abandonment and Renewal is one of the four Yahara 2070 scenarios. These stories depict fictional yet plausible futures for water and people in Wisconsin's Yahara watershed. Each scenario explores a different way people could address challenges to water sustainability and what the outcomes of those paths could be. They are not predictions, but explorations of the question, what if? Abandonment and Renewal explores what life in 2070 could be like if people are not prepared for water and climate challenges.
Chapter 1, An Introduction. From the ashes of catastrophe, life somehow manages to rise again. This thought hung on Daisy's mind, sweat pouring down her face, as she uttered a reassuring click to Bud and Betsy, the pair of Belgian draft horses drawing the plow. The community had outgrown its garden, and Daisy was charged with negotiating a new patch of rich soil from the shrubby old field, which had not seen a plow in decades. Despite the heat and her perspiration, she reveled in the back-breaking work. It was the full expression of her life purpose. Rebuilding. Daisy moved to the Hope Prairie community from the Great Lakes Climate Change Refuge 2 years ago with her husband, Felix. Over the years, the pressures of climate change had pushed thousands of people into refuges dispersed across the country. These safe havens were established by the federal government to absorb refugees who fled from communities destroyed by the climate's fury. Feeling crowded and thirsting for a life free from the stifling restrictions imposed on refugees, Daisy and Felix packed up their lives into two suitcases and made the journey to Wisconsin. 35 years prior, in the year 2035, Daisy and her mother fled Madison after the disaster. Daisy was barely a year old. Although she remembered nothing about her homeland, Daisy had always held on to the dream of returning there, an indescribable longing for an unfamiliar home. She knew from her mother that, because of the danger, few people still lived in Madison and the surrounding area. But Daisy and Felix hoped the largely abandoned landscape would offer them the chance to start a new life, and perhaps a new society. Following this glimmer of hope, they migrated toward a land from which so many had fled not too long ago. They took it as a sign that they stumbled upon Hope Prairie so quickly after their arrival to the Yahara. They spent their first night with an old friend of Daisy's mother, who lived in what was left of Middleton. When chatting about the couple's potential next steps, their hostess told them about the subsistence farming community with a big dream. Hope Prairie sounded exactly like what they were seeking. 3 years before Daisy and Felix's arrival, a troop of young, optimistic East Coast refugees merged with a clutch of equally young and optimistic Wisconsin dwellers to found Hope Prairie. The community blossomed from their shared dream of shaping a new society from the dust of Yahara's crumbled past. When the great disaster befell the watershed, the human population had been decimated, and many of the survivors fled. Most of the former human settlements lay in ruins, and the landscape had been transformed by the hands of nature. The resulting autonomy and rejuvenating ecosystems offered these idealistic homesteaders a virtually clean slate from which to realize their vision. The group settled in the ruins of a suburban development that hugged a former prairie preserve and some abandoned farmland. They fixed up a few of the large houses to create communal living spaces. As a subsistence farm, Hope Prairie resembles the few dozen of such farms that have filled the void industrial agriculture left after the disaster. For the most part, each cultivates only what it needs to feed its members. Hope Prairie has grown to 27 people. the homesteaders found the soil in the old farmland still ready for crops. A recent history of drought and fire allowed very few trees and shrubs to root on the sloping south-facing fields, which made them easy to till. The community's breaking of the rich soil seems somewhat reminiscent of settlers' past. The soil still replete with phosphorus, Hope Prairie's vegetables and fruits flourished in this nutrient-rich environment. Corn and soy lost their value after the disaster. Few people farm them anymore. The community also has a handful of dairy cows and a herd of goats, which are pasture-raised, now the widespread practice among Yahara's farms. A dozen chickens roam the central courtyard freely by day, but are locked up in the coop at night to keep them safe from the raccoons, foxes, and wolves. The community trades its surplus with neighboring subsistence farms and communities in the city center for goods they cannot make or services they cannot perform for themselves. This bartering system has replaced the monetary system of pre-disaster society. The community recently banded together with a neighboring farm to further diversify and expand their cropland, a collaborative model they are copying from other subsistence farms in the watershed. Daisy's current task was part of this new effort. The collaboration thrilled her, as it was proof to her their model was working. They could survive off the land and with each other, and work together in a productive partnership. In their new environment, they found nature to be a fickle roommate, feral and prone to mood swings. Only by working together and adapting to the shifting conditions could they survive. This lifestyle stands in contrast to life before the disaster. At least, according to how Daisy understood it. Back then, people largely ignored nature's complaints and warnings, and their ignorance set the course for the disaster from which this new society would sprout. Chapter 2: The Disaster Generation. As young adults in Madison in the 2020s, Daisy's parents, Jay and Amy, were part of what became known as the Disaster Generation. Born and raised in Wisconsin, they met during their undergraduate years at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and, like many, chose to stay in the area after graduation. Jay continued on to graduate school to study limnology and eventually became a research scientist, and Amy took a job at a local environmental nonprofit. Their lines of work placed them in the thick of the growing predicament around the region's deteriorating water quality, and they were among those fighting the upstream battle to turn around the dire situation. Climate change was intensifying more rapidly than predicted, and the devastation became more extensive than the United States was prepared to handle. After decades of inadequate preparation and inaction, the accumulation of droughts, storms, and disease outbreaks that struck the country and the globe eventually caused collapse in many regions. In the United States, the coasts and southern states were the hardest hit, a problem made worse by their large and dense populations. The federal government exhausted its capacity and resources on damage control in these areas, leaving the Midwest to fend for its own. Despite the national government's neglect, the Midwest was increasingly expected to feed the country, since food production in the disaster-weary coastal and southern states was falling rapidly. This decline catapulted food prices, and many Midwestern farmers capitalized on the resulting bonanza. Yahara's farmers were no exception. To keep up with the rising demand, they felt pressure to use more and more fertilizers, worsening the already immense eutrophication problem. Foreign investors and large corporations caught wind of the gold rush and began buying up and consolidating farmland. Absentee landowners were eager to sell, and the money outweighed any reason to keep their deteriorating land. As rental land disappeared, so too did the ability of small-scale farmers to make ends meet. They were left with little choice but to sell their farms to the corporations. Soon, the only farms left were massive corporate-owned farms that bullied any effort by regulators and watchdogs to reduce the intensified pollution-causing practices. At the same time, urban development spread over the phosphorus-rich land, increasing erosion and runoff into streams and lakes. Water quality quickly deteriorated, setting Yahara on a trajectory toward disaster.
The worsening state of Yahara's freshwater was largely disregarded by policymakers, industry, farmers, and the public, however. Because of the nation's food crisis, food production had become a matter of national security, and any attempt or suggestion to constrict production was seen as unpatriotic. Even humanitarian and food aid organizations saw no choice but to ignore the environmental warnings for the sake of feeding the nation. In fact, the Wisconsin state government declared it would waive runoff regulations in the name of national security. This sense of patriotic duty had become the only bipartisan issue the state had been able to rally around in years. Strong divisiveness, residual from earlier in the century, still saturated the air in the capital. In light of the chronic political discord and subsequent public disenchantment, the legislature's ability to shake hands across party lines on this decision was considered a victory. But this victory helped seal Yahara's fate. The 2020s and 2030s were exceptionally warm and wet. Frequent and ferocious storms caused the Yahara lakes to repeatedly breach their banks, and flooding was a recurrent problem. A devastating storm put the summer of 2031 in the history books. The storm caused Lakes Wabisa and Kiganza to overflow and converge, flooding the towns of Dunn and McFarland in the southern part of the watershed. Many of the existing control structures could not withstand the floodwaters, which consequently inundated most low-lying areas, destroying homes and property, drowning roads, and causing incalculable damage. Water management officials struggled with where to put the excess water, and most of the watershed was declared a disaster area. With little federal aid available to help clean up, and a state and local government unprepared to deal with the magnitude of the damage, conflict flared. While the floodwaters and tension receded by 2032, the bad luck continued. The flood of 2031 had sent a deluge of runoff into the lakes, worsening their already overtaxed waters. Lake Kiganza's unfortunate shallowness and position at the bottom of the lake chain made it the recipient of the most runoff. The lake became increasingly clogged up with putrid algae each summer. In the summer of 2033, a heat wave chased many people into its dirty waters to cool off. Neither officials' warnings to stay out of the lake nor the lake's stench could stop them. Late one muggy afternoon, with Kiganza cloaked in a green scum, a couple of dozen swimmers and three dogs mysteriously fell severely ill. The dogs and half the swimmers died by the following day. While this bizarre occurrence chased many people out of the water and caused a stir among the media and the public, its shelf life in the public's consciousness was similar to most disasters. Short. By autumn, it had already fallen from the public stage, relegated to merely a freak incident that probably wouldn't happen again. However, local scientists did not lose interest in the incident. A research team, which included Daisy's father, Jay, investigated the odoriferous algae that had bloomed the day before the tragedy. As they suspected, the culprit turned out not to be a tiny plant, but cyanobacteria. This particular species was no usual suspect, however. It was exotic and extremely toxic. Samples from the Yahara lakes show they were all infested. The depth of the other lakes had thus far prevented similar deadly blooms. But the depth would not be adequate defense for long. Catastrophe was brewing. The summer of 2035, Daisy's first year of life, was yet another scorcher. Another rainy spring preluded a series of heat waves, which set the stage for a perfect storm. Early summer blooms sent repugnant odors wafting through major corridors, up State Street, through Monona's lakeside neighborhoods, into downtown Middleton. Dane County issued frequent odor alerts, shutting down businesses and closing off streets when the air was too foul to breathe. The lakes were permanently closed to swimming due to the great numbers of people becoming ill from direct exposure to the bacteria via the skin and ingestion, some of them losing their lives. In the thick of the summer's third heat wave, the first wave of catastrophe hit. As the noonday sun climbed the sky one stagnant afternoon, the lake's calm, warm waters began to simmer with life. Masses of toxic cyanobacteria lurking in the lower lake layers floated to the surface, dyeing the waters a deadly bright green and exhaling a poisonous breath into the air. The fumes crept into the lungs of people on boats, along shorelines, at the Union Terrace, across the isthmus, and within any close proximity to the water, instantly sickening them. Within a couple of days, most of them died. Among the casualties was Jay. That morning, he had recognized the onset of optimal weather conditions for a massive bloom. Curious about the cyanobacteria's behavior, he had gone out in Lake Mendota to take samples. He returned severely ill and died the next day. As the death toll climbed over the following days, hysteria swept over the Yahara. The hospitals lacked the capacity to help the torrents of afflicted people. The county lacked the resources to do anything to help, and the state lacked the organization to adequately respond. The capital's proximity to the lakes had led to the demise of several state legislators and high-level administrators. With so many officials falling victim, the government fell too, into a state of emergency. Disaster plans had never considered a catastrophe of such size, and decision makers were at a loss for how to bring order to the chaos. Their pleas for federal assistance went unanswered as the nation's money and attention continued to be funneled to the regions ravaged by storms and seas. Recognizing their insurmountable dilemma, state and county officials agreed to evacuate the watershed. It seemed the only option. People were already fleeing, and with the capital at the disaster's epicenter, no one was willing to stay behind to assist survivors and clean up the lakes. It was simply too dangerous. Throughout the hot summer, the bacteria claimed more victims in a series of episodic blooms. On exceptionally hot and stagnant days, any person who walked downwind of their potent odor would get a deadly whiff. Once sickened by the bacteria's fumes, one's chances of survival were slim. The mortality rate was roughly 90%. Many of the fatalities were the young, elderly, and immune compromised. Only the hardiest individuals survived. While people had discovered safe zones far away enough from the lakes, the resulting restrictedness and uncertainty of life made staying in the region an undesirable option. Fear and hopelessness drove away thousands of survivors. Even so, some people were unable or unwilling to leave so quickly, Amy among them. As the tragedy sank in, unrest boiled among those who stayed. Some took out their anger with looting and violence. Others channeled theirs into grassroots efforts to rectify the wrongs that had led to the tragedy. Enraged and emboldened by her grief, Amy joined a citizens group called Lake Justice. While fingers were pointed in many directions, the scapegoat became Cropco, the largest corporate farm giant in the watershed, which was attempting to keep its business going amid the chaos. Its operations had played a big role in befouling the lakes, and the company's leaders had ignored the danger they were creating. But despite Cropco's size, they were no match against Lake Justice. The abdication of state and county government left no judicial system to deal with the accusations against the company. With so many farm workers gone, no support from the state, and a clear sense of industrial agriculture's death in the region, Cropco leaders eventually caved to the citizen outrage, sensing they had no choice but to close up shop. mob rule prevailed. A similar fate cascaded through the industry as agricultural corporations throughout the watershed abandoned their operations. Suddenly, Yahara's feeding tube to the nation was cut.
By the summer's end, the toxic bacteria had taken the lives of more than 100,000 people. Although slowing, the exodus to safer air continued. By winter, the only people left in the watershed were a handful of farmers determined to see the harvest through, and those too poor or reluctant to leave. Some refugees followed the state government, which had moved its surviving operations to Wisconsin's original capital, Belmont. The town's location in the Driftless area rendered it attractive. The region's dearth of lakes meant it was safe from the cyanobacteria, and the rugged topography invited the migrants to establish farms. But many of Yahara's homeless were too enraged by the state's ineptitude at preventing the crisis to follow them. Or they were too fearful the catastrophe could happen elsewhere in the state, where runoff prevention measures were equally ineffective. So they left Wisconsin altogether. Once symbols of pride, Wisconsin's lakes had acquired new meanings of danger and death. They were no longer natural assets to which people were drawn, but natural disasters waiting to happen. Grief-stricken for her husband and her home, Amy eventually joined the exodus. While Lake Justice helped drive industrial agriculture from the watershed, they could do nothing about the ecological mess that was left behind. No other choice in sight. Amy and baby Daisy followed the flood of refugees to the Great Lakes Climate Change Refuge, one of the federal government's newly established strongholds for climate refugees. Within a few years, the watershed's population dwindled to less than one-tenth of its pre-disaster size. The majority of those who stayed lacked the financial or social resources to flee. They lived among the ruins of the abandoned settlements. Ghost towns haunted the landscape. Shops and restaurants, empty of their people, but not of their wares, waited in vain for customers. Houses and office buildings remained standing, as though they expected their occupants to be home or back from lunch break any minute. The Yahara disaster joined a growing list of climate and environmental catastrophes to which people around the world had succumbed in the middle of the 21st century. Famine, migration, and unrest sent wealthy countries, the United States included, into states of fear and paranoia, prompting them to bolster their military defenses and close their borders to contain their problems. Infected by a fend-for-oneself mentality, these countries became increasingly isolated. Relationships were severed, networks broke down, the global economy eroded. Stressed by chronic crisis, the U.S. government's coffers and stamina rapidly dwindled. Regions such as the Yahara lay neglected at the bottom of the national triage list. However, this neglect helped lay the groundwork for a drastic transformation in the watershed.
Chapter 3. A Watershed Restoration.
With a running start, Felix hurled himself off the pier into Lake Wingra's cooling waters. Instant invigoration swept over him as the sweaty film that covered his body turned into cool lake wetness. Summers are hot in Madison, hotter than they used to be, but the lake offers some relief. No one has air conditioners anymore. The scarcity and unreliability of electricity doesn't allow such a luxury. The climate had defied early century scientists' predictions. It had slipped into something warmer, flaunting temperatures an average of 8 degrees higher than 50 years prior. Felix floated contentedly. Summer was still nascent, and it was not yet the time of the year when being so close to Lake Mendota and Monona could be lethal. With large-scale agriculture now extinct in Yahara and a nearly vanished impact from urban runoff, lake water quality is on the mend. Lake Wingra especially has benefited from the abandonment. There is no longer any need, or anyone, to sand or salt city streets, relieving the lake of the silt that plagued its waters earlier in the century. As a lake fed by now-recovered springs, rather than Yahara River like the others, Lake Wingra has received a continuous flush of clean water, quickly improving its water quality to a swimmable state if you can get out past the weeds. The toxic cyanobacteria that had caused the disaster still linger in other lakes, however, exhaling their poison when the summer is at its hottest. During these months, people and most animals simply avoid getting too close or migrate to escape the fumes. Hope Prairie is several miles southwest of Madison, a safe enough distance that allows them to remain there year-round, as long as they don't venture too far in the wrong direction. Seasonal and sometimes restricted movement is part of the new pattern of life. Lake Wingra's swampy shores are thick and wild with vegetation. What used to be Vilas Park is overgrown, hiding the ruins of homes and the empty neighborhood around it. Felix often tries to picture what the neighborhood and the park used to look like, busy with people. It's hard to believe this jungle had been so manicured but a short time ago. Nature moves quickly when unbridled. After the disaster, while Yahara's people slowly struggled to get back on their feet, nature and time worked together in quick step. By land and water, the ecosystems began an uninhibited course of succession. Nature seemed to rejoice in its liberation, stretching its limbs into the spaces the people left. Houses and buildings, picked over by survivors, decayed to mere shells, and grasses, flowers, shrubs, and trees sprouted across the earth they once knew. All around the watershed, wetland, savanna, and forest eventually took back the nooks and crannies humans had vacated. The course of succession was somewhat predictable. Ecology textbooks used to describe a similar course for old farm fields that lay fallow, except now more exotic plants emerged in the mix. In the wake of the abandonment, the exposed soil endured several years of heavy erosion as the climate became even soggier the decade following the disaster. But, eventually, weeds took root and spread, setting the stage for longer-lived trees and shrubs which soon followed. By the 2050s, the climate began to dry out. The landscape slowly became more arid, as intermittent drought returned to the climatic rhythm. Prairie and savanna became to return, pruned by frequent wildfires. By now, native and invasive plant species have settled into place, and the landscape blooms with a novel but still maturing mix of the old and the new. Felix heard a loud rustle on the shoreline that startled him into alertness. Cougars are known to stalk these shores, and even though he knew the odds that one would bother to jump in after him were minuscule, he couldn't help but feel a sense of dread as he eyed the distance between himself and the pier where his machete lay. Then, a trumpet-like noise bellowed from the trees, and the mammoth head of an elephant emerged. Phew, thought Felix. Just an elephant. Also novel to the post-disaster watershed is a motley crew of fauna. Nearly rid of humans, their only predator, wolves and big cats returned. At first, they feasted off of abandoned livestock and pets. As time went on, they adjusted their palates to the evolving mix of herbivores, a collection that consists of mostly small animals such as squirrels, woodchuck, cottontail rabbits, and former game birds such as wild turkey, ducks, and grouse. The once abundant white-tailed deer is now rare in this part of the state. A disease had decimated the herds back in the 2020s. Feral pigs eagerly fill the resounding ecological void. Some species, such as beaver and mink, made a healthy comeback to the watershed,
their abundance matching that of their ancestors in the 1800s.
And the elephants? They're mostly zoo escapees, but also strays from private collections. During the agricultural gold rush, as many of the country's frequented tourist destinations on the coasts became submerged or otherwise uninhabitable, Dane County smelled the opportunity to become a new leading tourist destination. With its sudden influx of wealth, it had begun to spruce up the watershed's attractiveness, which included buying a menagerie of new animals for the zoo, including a small herd of elephants. After the disaster, with no humans left to feed them and crazed by hunger, many of the zoo animals managed to break free from their enclosures. They scattered about the landscape, and those able to survive on their own created unique pockets within the ecosystem. Social and intelligent, the elephants have been particularly successful survivors, even in the now milder winters. Once they settled into the regenerating savannas and wetlands, which resembled their ancestral habitats, they filled the ecological niche left empty by the extinction of their pachyderm predecessors, the mammoth and the mastodon, thousands of years prior. Zoo animals weren't the only strangers to set up camp in the watershed. A number of foreign reptiles, mammals, and birds, especially those native to southern states, had migrated to Wisconsin, taking advantage of the expanded habitat range the warmer temperatures laid out for them. Armadillo, cottonmouth snakes, and ostrich, surplus from Texas's collapsed ostrich meat market, are now common. The lakes teem with unique blend of native and non-native fish. Northern pike, black bass, sunfish, tilapia, and exotic Central American catfishes. Non-native plants had hitched a ride with the wind and migrating animals, moving in with Wisconsin natives along the lakeshores and across the landscape, creating plant communities never before convened in the world. Felix often thinks of Hope Prairie, also a mix of migrants and natives, as similar to the novel flora and fauna communities that had formed in post-disaster Yahara. Like the plants and wildlife, the community had also learned to work with what is available to them and to adapt to ever-changing conditions in pursuit of resilience. A secret to which their plant and animal brethren were already privy, and pre-disaster society had failed to crack. Resilience for the post-disaster people also meant reconciliation with Yahara's lakes. With industrial agriculture and expansive urbanization gone, water quality has improved since the disaster and is continuing on a healing path, despite the scars it still carries from its polluted past. Post-disaster Yahara people underwent an enhanced sense of dependency on the lakes, as compared to previous generations. Fish, small game, and some riparian and aquatic plants are central to their diets. The lakes and their tributaries are also transportation hubs, since public transit and cars were made obsolete by the decaying infrastructure and lack of access to oil and gas. Thus, as in previous generations, the lakes are the livelihoods of the post-disaster people. Unlike previous generations, this dependence is magnified, and there is a universal acceptance of the necessary precautions to protecting the lakes. The disaster had left a deep wound in the Yahara people's psyche. No one was willing to try that luck again. In this sense, the meanings the Yahara people attached to the lakes once again shifted after the disaster. As the disaster generation aged and the memory of the tragedy faded, the lake's symbolization of death and danger also faded. They moved back to the center of the collective cultural identity, but not as glorified landscape decor, there for human pleasure. Rather,
They embody the Yahara people's renewed connection with the ecosystem. Dynamic, dependent, and deferent. To Daisy, Lake Mendota especially carries a poignant meaning. Its surface reflects the lore of the disaster and the ghost of her father. And its waters swarm with irony. Once death-bringing, but now life-giving. Similarly, the Yahara people's lifestyle, especially that of Hope Prairie, has transformed, and a sense of stewardship has become pervasive. In their reconciliation, both the lakes and the people have apologized to each other for their unintended transgressions. Stewardship goes hand in hand with survival. Some might say the Yahara people's life quality has fallen a few notches. They live simply and efficiently, using all that is available to them, and wasting nothing. Clothing is handed down until threadbare, when it then becomes rags and other scrap material. Furniture picked from abandoned homes is given new lives, or broken down for fuel. Abandoned backyards become cropland. Plastic bags are reused with a longevity unheard of in pre-disaster times. Books, fishing poles, tattered board games, and bicycles serve the pastime needs. What little pastime is allowed by day-to-day existence. Healthcare is limited, with no organized system, save a couple of small clinics and a few trained medical professionals. Given the spotty availability of medical resources, people are highly vulnerable to diseases. Influenza, tuberculosis, and other diseases that were once well controlled occasionally flare up in communities. And invasive diseases like dengue fever pose new threats. People with formerly easily treatable disabilities, such as myopia and hernias, find life to be quite hindered. Medical emergencies, such as appendicitis and heart attacks, are usually fatal, unless the patient can get to one of the hospitals outside the watershed in time. The adage, life is hard, has regained its connotations once antiquated by industrialization. Winters, even if milder, are unquestionably hard. Others, however, might say the Yahara people have reached a higher level of life quality, as their lifestyle is focused on happiness, connection, and resilience, rather than wealth and material goods. Wood scraps have more value than the cell phones, computers, and other personal technologies that were left to waste after the disaster. The mundane have become luxuries. The luxuries have become trash. Solar panels and small-scale wind generators are among the few abandoned technological items that have proved useful in post-disaster society. However, electricity is a luxury afforded to only those living in a few of the communities on the outskirts. The rest rely on wood from abandoned buildings and from forests for fuel. Overall, technological progress has been relegated to the yet-forgotten old days, back when pre-disaster society let wanton materialism rule. Arraign post-disaster people, view as their predecessors, doom. While resourcefulness and resilience are survival factors for all post-disaster people, the motivations to make a go of it in the feral watershed differ somewhat. Daisy, Felix, Hope Prairie, and their fellow subsistence farms and intentional communities are mavericks, attracted to the wildness of the landscape and the chance to blaze a new trail for society. The freedom allowed by the region's lack of governance lured others to the watershed, and poverty gave others no choice. In the post-disaster population mosaic, the subsistence farms and communities form a periphery around a few highly dense urban clusters, though they look more like compact towns in pre-disaster terms. These clusters are inhabited primarily by disaster survivors and their descendants, who had neither the material nor the social resources to leave.
The abandonment included that by the federal government, which viewed the region's plight as a lost cause. Survivors had no choice but to stay, weather the disaster, and rebuild on their own. In the post-disaster era, inequality and individualism spell danger. Both interfere with the resourcefulness and cooperation that enable survival. Individuals who are unable to cooperate with fellow survivors to find food, water, and shelter to simply live became isolated and eventually disappeared. While some of these individuals' inability to cooperate was based in a general unwillingness, others suffered from severe depression or post-traumatic stress disorder. Since no services remained to help them through their darkness, those unable to cope simply fell to the social wayside. They constituted the second wave of the disaster's victims. In a sense, inequality has dissipated in post-disaster society. With social services as non-existent as a central government, and no coordinated system otherwise to provide any sort of framework, cooperation across social strata has been crucial throughout the renewal period. Communities have helped each other get back on their feet and find pathways forward. They have forged ties to share, trade, or teach basic needs and skills, especially since it became easier to specialize in certain products or services and thereby create a division of labor. Hope Prairie community is known for its goat milk and meat products, which it trades with nearby urban communities for goods and services, such as metalwork and carpentry. Isolated from the global economy, which had teetered further into collapse, post-disaster, Yahara's bartering system is serving more needs than merely the exchange of goods. Along with reliable communication technology, gone are the digital social networks that had constructed much of the social scaffolding and knowledge sharing earlier in the century. Bartering and survival have become the bones and sinews for the watershed's new social network.
Chapter 4, The Resilience Generation.
Felix gave Willie a reassuring nudge to the flank as they crested the hill toward Hope Prairie. The old horse needed encouragement to keep moving on hot days. The saddlebags, laden with the day's bounty, an assortment of berries and fish, surely didn't help either. They passed by a neighboring farm's field, abloom with rows of leafy greens, squashes, and tomatoes. Though still early summer, the growing season had shifted significantly in the past couple of decades. As they plodded by, they caught the attention of a large, unfriendly-looking dog, probably one of those wolf mixes that farmers had begun breeding. The dog promptly sent them a warning bark. People have been having problems with elephants raiding their fields, and these wolf mixes provide some guardianship over the fields. Their might is minimal, though, given the intrepidness of an elephant. When Felix and Willie arrived at the barn, they found Daisy unhitching Bud and Betsy. Horsepower had indeed taken back its original meaning, a thought that flitted across Felix's mind, amusing him. The community shares one pickup truck, the engine of which they rigged to run on food grease. They are one of the few farms large enough to produce enough biodiesel to occasionally run a truck engine. Even so, they're always running low. Horses are much more reliable. With the horses tucked away in their stalls, Felix and Daisy headed for the common house, where the community members were assembling for a meeting. The order of business was with the community well. While groundwater quality had slowly improved alongside the lakes, problems with roots in the past still persisted.
The recklessness of the disaster generation's agricultural practices had saturated the soil and groundwater with nitrate, a fertilizing nutrient that is harmful in excess. Since the community lacks the equipment to dig wells that can reach the deeper aquifers, they can access only the shallow groundwater, which is still nitrate-ridden. But the need for water outweighs the risks, and no severe signs of contamination had appeared until recently. Within a couple of weeks after the birth of one couple's first child, his hands, feet, and mouth turned blue. Also Hope Prairie's firstborn, the ailing baby sent the entire community into a state of concern. An older community member, who is a Wisconsin native, had recalled hearing about such symptoms as blue baby syndrome, a disease caused by the ingestion of water with excessive nitrates. Alarmed, the community debated what to do. Should they dig a new well elsewhere, perhaps upland, away from old farm fields, or near a wetland, which might remove the nitrate? Or maybe they should build cisterns and drink rainwater instead. It is uncertain whether the decision will help the baby, however. His condition worsened, and his parents took him to the state's main hospital in Belmont, the recrowned capital, to save him. Past-rooted problems are found not only in the water. With the dust from the disaster settled and a feeling of stasis growing, inklings of pre-disaster life, the way things used to be, are beginning to emerge. And with them, some of the sides of society Hope Prairie has been trying to avoid. Some members of a neighboring farm, which was known as a survivalist haven, have become paranoid about a return of government rule and industrial agriculture. They have come to Hope Prairie a few times now to discuss forming an ad hoc troop of vigilantes to police the watershed and watch for the potential arrival of a governance task force or corporate prospectors. Hope Prairie does want to preserve their autonomy, but this defensive mentality is discordant with their peaceful vision. The community has also been hearing rumors that a small group of better-off townfolk erected a gate around their enclave, worried that the neighboring communities would try to steal their accumulated goods and resources. And while the region's reputation as a toxic hazard keeps most outsiders out, a few have found their way in, usually sniffing out economic interests. A couple of businessmen from Belmont recently moved to Madison with eyes out for entrepreneurial prospects. When the toxic stench isn't too ripe, they detect the scent of an economic comeback in the blossoming of post-disaster society. Collectively, the Yahara people are ambivalent about what this could mean. Resilience is the ability of nature and its systems to bounce back from disturbances and catastrophes. In ecology, this is somewhat of a nirvana. Social resilience, or the ability of a society to adapt or transform in response to environmental change, is equally nirvanic. While resilience lies at the end of their rainbow, Hope Prairie's community vision does not entail a bouncing back to the way things used to be. Developments that hint of inequality, unequal wealth, resources, power, and access are unwelcome artifacts of pre-disaster life and don't fit into their vision for a new world. They are not rebuilding with the same bricks used by generations before them. Theirs is the resilience generation. Unexpected turns and hazards surely lie in the road ahead. But like generations before them, it will be their challenge to navigate the surprises and find the route toward a prosperous future.
The Yahara 2070 scenarios were part of a research endeavor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison called the Water Sustainability and Climate Project. The project was funded by the National Science Foundation to explore how changes in land use, climate, and human demands could impact the future of water and people in the Yahara watershed. One goal was to discover new insights on how to build resilience for the watershed and similar regions around the upper Midwest. Another goal was to help us imagine possible futures and think about what would be desirable. The Yahara 2070 stories were written by Jenny Seifert, but they are based on input from people who live in the Yahara watershed and incorporate ideas from around the globe. Kai Brito narrated and produced these audio stories. More information about the Yahara 2070 scenarios can be found at yahara2070.org. That's yahara2070.org.